Ich brauche eine Minute von euch. Wenn ihr diesen Podcast hört und mögt, gehört ihr zu denen, die Marke nicht für Dekoration halten, sondern für einen strategischen Hebel. Doch Markenführung ist heute anspruchsvoller denn je. Mehr Möglichkeiten, mehr Meinungen und auch mehr Hype. Viele Marketeers stehen unter Druck, die richtigen Entscheidungen zu treffen und zu rechtfertigen. Dabei gibt es sie, valide Prinzipien, belegte Erfolgsfaktoren und klare Modelle. Viele Mythen der Markenführung sind empirisch widerlegt. Trotzdem bleiben sie weit verbreitet, verschwenden Budget und verschenken Wirkung. Und aus unzähligen Gesprächen mit Markenverantwortlichen wissen wir, was am meisten fehlt, ist nicht Kreativität, sondern verlässliche Orientierung. Die Fähigkeit, den Hype von Substanz zu unterscheiden und strategische Fragen mit Selbstvertrauen zu beantworten. Genau da setzen wir an. Wenn ihr Inspiration, Orientierung und Entscheidungssicherheit wollt, dann könnt ihr Markenkraft auch live buchen. Als Keynote für euer Event, als Inhouse-Seminar für euer Team oder in unserer zweitägigen Masterclass. Uwe Munzinger und ich geben einen strukturierten Überblick über das, was Markenkraft erzeugt und Marken wachsen lässt. Fundiert, praxisnah und direkt anwendbar. Klingt interessant? Dann findet ihr mehr Infos unter markenkraft.org. Danke für eure Zeit und vielleicht bis bald.
Willkommen bei einer neuen Episode von Markenkraft. Für alle, die von Marken fasziniert und für ihr Wohlergehen verantwortlich sind.
My name is Olaf Hartmann, and today's topic I will discuss with my guest Mats Georgesen starts with one of the biggest misunderstandings of marketing. Most marketing starts with the wrong assumption. We assume that the people out there are constantly thinking about our category, comparing brands, evaluating options. But in reality, something very different is happening. Most of the time, people are not thinking about your brand at all. And most of the time, they're not even thinking about our category either. Demand is asleep. It only wakes up in specific moments, when a situation appears, a problem emerges, or a need suddenly becomes real. And the brands that grow are not necessarily the ones with the most thrilling campaign. They are the ones that show up naturally in more of those moments. Over the past two decades, the research of Ehrenberg Bass Institute, the IPA, things that Mark Ritson has talked about a lot, has shown something remarkably clear. Brands grow primarily by becoming mentally available. The idea is simple but powerful. People don't buy brands in the abstract, they buy them in specific situations. When a brand is not remembered in that moment, it will simply not be chosen. This insight has fundamentally reshaped modern brand strategy. And today it forms a core pillar of evidence-based marketing. But this is exactly where an interesting extension begins. Because my guest today argues that this insight is correct, but not yet fully developed. Demand, he says, is not created by a single motive in moment of demand and coming up. In those moments, it emerges out of a complex, intertwined system of associations, a so-called demand point constellation, or that's how he calls it. The core idea is both elegant and challenging. Growth does not only come from being remembered in many situations, it comes from occupying a coherent constellation of recurring demand moments, situations that reinforce each other structurally. And this we have to unpack with Mats Georgesen. He was global brand director of Sony Ericsson, taught 10 years as a guest professor at Stockholm University, and has spent more than 25 years as a consultant working at the intersection of strategy, branding, and business growth. Through his firm, Georgesen and Company, he advises companies and leadership teams around the world how to identify and unlock new sources of growth. His work builds on many of the insights from evidence-based marketing, but he also pushes them further. And along the way, he raises some thoughtful and sometimes critical questions about how brands are managed today. That's why I invited him here. And I can only say, welcome, Mats. I was really looking forward to speaking to you. Great that you're with us today.
Thank you so much, Olaf. What an introduction. Great. I hope I will do it justice today.
the stage is set. And now we can relax and start with you as a person, because when I'm talking to you, you're in Brazil. But how you got there, we'll discuss later. But I would like to take a little time travel back to your time in Sweden, because you grew up in Sweden. And during that time, you get in touch with money for the first time. And my question is, like, what is the first money you earned and how did it come about?
You know, it was kind of funny because technically speaking, it was marketing. But I started working extra. I was only 13 years old or so. And I made a catalog, like, you know, in binders for architects, for lighting solutions, for sort of public environments and stuff like that. Like a kind of professional B2B vendor of these things. So we would come in the weekend and sort of put these together and send them out to people who requested them.
And your job was the catalog production. You were hired to do the catalog production.
Yes, yes. Highly skilled labor. Like,
highly,
you know,
skilled.
I had to pick pieces of paper in a certain order and put them in a binder, put the binder in a box,
yep,
and send it to a specified address.
Excellent. That connects our childhood, because when I was 16, I did exactly the same thing for a company selling products for galleries and stuff. So I learned a lot about frames and all the material that is used in galleries and producing catalogs, basically. Okay. And so that was the first money you got in your hands. And do you remember what you spent it on?
I think it was like a lot of heavy metal records and role-playing games. You know, those kind of things. But it was awesome. But I mean, I think it also kind of very early sort of made me understand a little bit that this was part of a machine, you know. It wasn't, mm-hmm. I was, thank God, you know, smart enough to see that I didn't just like do a mindless thing, that it was actually a cog in something that started, so to say, with, or at least I was part of, like a big chain of building a market and tapping it and so forth. And it was kind of like my first glimpse into, like, wow, there's like all this economic activity going on in the world that you never see. So
right. So that moment you understood there was like a bigger system behind it, like to generate demand, send out these catalogs. And was there a moment where you realized, okay, so how this business works? Like, I put together these sheets of paper and then in the end, business comes in?
Yeah, I think it really sort of dawned on me. But I think I've always been kind of like a systems person that sort of analyzes, maybe overthinks too much, but that I kind of always wondered, like, you know, what's behind this thing that I'm seeing in front of me? What came before? What comes after? So yeah, I'm very, very grateful for this, because I came from, my parents were, you know, successful people in their own right, but they came from a very different culture. You know, in the sort of 70s Sweden, people wanted to sort of do careers as public bureaucrats, you know, and mm-hmm. they were quite good at that. But my upbringing was not entrepreneurial. It was not business. Mm-hmm. But because of this experience very early, I kind of also realized that there is like, this is like where the money really comes from, you know?
There's another world out there.
Yeah. So it was very, very foundational for me that I started working at an early age on the side of school. So
right. Yeah. And when was the first time you got in touch with the concept of brand? Like, either by experiencing something where you said, okay, well, this is really powerful. Like, I buy something which is functionally the same, but I want it. I want this one instead of that one.
That was almost like, like a renaissance in its own right, because I have always also been happy to sort of draw things and design things. I've been doing that my whole life for various reasons. And when I was in high school, I kind of gradually discovered that advertising kind of exists as a business. And that fascinated me to no end. So I was like reading you know, the sort of classics like Ogilvy and the Bill Birnbach stuff and everything, like the classic advertising of the 60s and 70s when I went to high school in the 80s. And I first, of course, got like really hooked on the creative side, like, you know, that these things just ended up with such elegant solutions. And I thought that was kind of cool. And, you know, and in a superficial way, in a way, also like, you know, can you actually sort of become a millionaire by just coming up with these things?
The glamour world of advertising in the 80s and 90s. Yeah.
But very fast, I also realized when I read these books that they were such deep thinkers, you know, they really went to the bottom of everything. And it was also like a time of high stakes that you couldn't do what you can do now, like put up a little bit and experiment and see what seems to stick. They had to bet their entire existence, you know, on this is going to work for Heinz, you know, or this is going to make it possible to sell Volkswagens in the US. I mean, talk about all in. And I was so fascinated because when you read these stories, how they could sort of come up with what you first thought were brilliant solutions, and then you turn the page and they're like, but we decided not to run it because it had this problem. And I was like, wasn't that fixable? You know, my God, it was so good. But no, they were perfectionists because they had to be.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that just to sort of go out on a limb here, I think that something has been lost since, because the way these guys had to be precise in their thinking, because they had to commit so hard to what they recommended their clients and their companies would do, also made them really, really good.
And why do you think that that is different? Because they were not part of a holding company, and those clients were so big for them. If it didn't work for the client, it was like a economic risk for the client. But Heinz was back then also a huge company. With a failed campaign, they wouldn't go bankrupt. But the agencies there, the fate of the agencies was very much connected to these large clients.
Yeah. And I mean, the agency would get fired instantly if they didn't deliver. The people working on an account, that was the culture, you know, they would be fired. I mean, everybody involved, it was like really this kind of like, you know, you either become a hero or you sort of get executed kind of mentality in the industry. Yeah. And I think that, but it's kind of natural in a way, because the way they had to commit the funds, you know, would be like, this is what we're going to do this year. You know, like there is all the chips are on the table. And I think it made them into brilliant thinkers. And I think that we did lose some of that, or a lot of it, frankly, especially when the world got digital and we have the sort of power to experiment, which theoretically should make us better, but in a way, just like, you know, if you use AI all the time, you will become a sloppier thinker.
I just wanted to say that, because back then, like, creating like really beautiful artwork was painstakingly slow, like hiring the right photographer, and then he took the picture on material, and if that picture scratched, then you had a big problem, and then you needed the right resolution and then the right colors and then the reproduction of the colors in the print media or wherever it was used. It was just so much more art, like so much more craft. And I remember just the digitalization of the print industry. There was already how much easier everything got just by desktop publishing.
I'm actually old enough. One of the fun little tidbits that I kind of haven't told anyone, but when I started, also I worked extra in my early 20s with art in an ad agency, and at this time, I don't know if you did that in Germany, but in Sweden, we still translated a lot of the movie titles. Mm-hmm. So we had a client, UIP.
You mean dubbing, like the voice, like
yes,
voiceover?
But also like the name of the movie itself. So
okay.
Hunt for Red October with Sean Connery was Jakten på Röd Oktober.
Ooh.
And I did the Swedish movie poster.
Okay.
And it was kind of like a very hands-on thing, because you had to make, you know, movies kind of have like logos in a way on the poster. Mm-hmm. If
It's a composition of the whole story. You see the submarine, the characters, they all have to arrange, be arranged in the center. And so you were working in an advertising agency then.
Yes. And that particular movie actually had even merchandise. So I made baseball caps and stuff in Swedish, like with the Swedish title. And the Swedish title had like, you know, the funny dots over the some of the letters, right? So I had to be very creative about it because those letters did not exist even in the sort of, so I had to like design it from scratch. I loved it.
And that is a very valuable experience to have done this hands-on and then later on go into strategy, because, you know, in the end, execution is strategy. If you can't execute, the greatest strategy is worth half. I mean, a great strategy is always valuable, but with bad execution, it loses immediately half or more than of its value. And then you went into you were global brand director of Sony Ericsson. As I said, you were going into brand management basically after you studied.
Yeah.
And you ended up in Brazil. So let's try to make a story arc that puts you in the end where you're sitting now. tell us, how did that happen?
Well, how do I tell a story of like 30 years in 30 seconds or less?
It doesn't have to be
seconds. Well, basically my enamorment of this sort of thinking about the advertising made me determined, like, I'm going to study this more than anybody else. So I went to the United States and I got a master's and a PhD while working also on the side of both teaching at university and at ad agencies. And then I went back to Sweden and I entered Ericsson and I had a fast career there. So I ended up being like the global brand director and also the global brand director for Sony Ericsson when that started. And I'm telling this arc because two things. I worked very internationally ever since I started with this, we're not thinking about like a home market, but thinking about the world market. Like, how does this company navigate with its offer across all the borders? How do you sort of get steerage so you can do wonderful things in the entire world, not sort of say something that builds on an idea from something that is very specifically German or something like that. The second is that I very early in that also discovered what I had already read, of course, that marketing is not just about promotions. In fact, many times the sort of communicational aspect of communication is very, very much the sort of last thing you should pay attention to sequentially. Because, for instance, when Ericsson was like really hurting, I mean, the problem was, we don't have to go into what the problem specifically was, but where it lay was the product development simply did not crank out the kind of products that people would want to buy. And in that kind of environment, if you're responsible for the brand, it's very daft if you sort of sit in meetings with an ad agency trying to come up with a better slogan. It just won't move the needle. So at this point, I felt like, you know, I can't really buy consultants that understand this because they say that they work holistically, but they are advertising and design people. So it's not helpful to me because my problems lay deeper. So when I finally decided that, you know, after all, I got to think about what to do next. I can't be a telecom director my whole life, right? I started my own consultancy. And with this mix of theory and practice, I basically tackled these issues ever since for a vast number of companies. But then comes like 4 years ago, I was getting, so to say, too comfortable in life, if you know what I mean. I think some people kind of wake up at some point in their life and sort of thinking like, what am I going to do with the rest of it? For me personally and professionally, I wanted more adventure. I wanted to sort of be even more exposed to the world and be outside my comfort zone. So I decided to move from Sweden. And for various reasons, I ended up in Brazil. almost by accident. But then I realized, like, I'm sitting here between two time zones, the US and Europe. I'm in a totally different environment that forces me to learn Portuguese. It's exactly what I wanted. So
Right. And yeah, Brazil is I mean, in if you love advertising, you know, great advertising comes out of Brazil, and great branding also. So it's a it's a very design like sensitive culture there. It's like
And it's a very interesting country, because I hope Brazilians will not mind me saying this, but it's like two parallel societies. They have, you know, whether you I'm not being opinionated on it, it's more a fact that they have like a poor Brazil and a rich Brazil. The rich Brazil is very affluent and lives like a parallel life to the poor people. But the advertising kind of like works in both these parallel universes. And I think that that is maybe a reason why they're so creative. They have to be very direct because they sort of have to sort of strike very visually and directly. So it's a fascinating environment.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you. So now you are in this inspiring place, and you inspire yourself, the world, also the LinkedIn world, that's for sure. You have a very distinctive style that many of my listeners will have seen on LinkedIn, like a cartoonish style to talk about your favorite topic, which is how brands grow, or brand growth. We talked before about this, that some people ask you to do content marketing for you because your content marketing works so well. But you give away a lot of extraordinary amount of strategic thinking publicly. What made you do that? Like, what motivated you to do it also in the, in this form, the way you do it?
Oh, I think, frankly, it ties back to my high school story. In a little way, I wanted to sort of give back what I got out of Bill Byrne back in Ogilvy, the kind of like spark that it was like entertainment that made me see new things. And I kind of think, I mean, I'm turning this into a book, but my ambition was, frankly, that I would make tidbits that make you kind of think about marketing in different ways without it feeling overwhelming that you have to sort of read like an entire book. And
And it looks like movies, like that explains, like you designed a movie poster, and all your style is like movie posters constantly. So let's go to the core of what you always talk about, is like growth. Is like, was there a moment when what fundamentally changed your thinking about how companies grow, and obviously how brands grow? Do you remember when you had a realization in that direction?
Yes, it came creeping on me, but I think, frankly, it's both from personal experience. I've been consulting with maybe 200 companies or something like that, and I've been with some companies that have grown tremendously fast over a long period of time, and I have also consulted for companies where theoretically we should have been successful, but it just didn't materialize. And I got this gnawing sort of feeling that everything is not so well explained, because there are like some really qualitative differences when things go right and things really take off, and when things don't. So, and then also when I started comparing it with theory, I felt like, you know, we've seen a lot of good new theory, or sort of say at least theory that has become popularized by practitioners to a much larger extent than before, which is a great development. But at the same time, I felt like, you know, sometimes it kind of just works only so far. I mean, like, for instance, I love the idea that brands grow primarily by increasing penetration. But to me, that's like, yeah, you know, to sell more, you need to have more customers. That's a little bit like, you know, if a kid asks you, how do I get rich? And you tell them, you have to make more money.
By getting more money. Or you know, how do plants grow? Yeah. By getting bigger. It doesn't help you like to decide on Monday morning what to do.
Exactly. And the little kid that asks you for advice would sort of like stick out his tongue and run away, right? But we take this very seriously. Like, this is like the biggest breakthrough we've ever heard, you know, that in order to grow, you need more customers. Yay.
Yeah. Well, there's for a long time, there was this mental model that growth comes from loyal customers. So we're trying to sell more things to the people that like us already, because that's so much easier. That was the narrative behind it.
Yes.
And obviously that's a switch from realizing, you know, the data doesn't support that. So basically we need to get more infrequent buyers and not bank on our frequent buyers.
That I think is good. And I think that you're nailing what I think is one of the big contributions that we have today, is that we used to have a topology of theory that was more or less like, you know, not really tested and many times not even falsifiable. It was just like, you know, normative statements like, this is good, like, you know, make your customers more loyal. And apart from that not being very useful either, it's also kind of like, is that even true? So yes, I think that it's very, very valuable. But to me, it's more like, you know, getting a more solid foundation, like something to stand on. But then you need to jump, you know,
right,
to grow.
Right, right. Let's help people out there listening to us to jump and like unpack basically some basic principles. The one thing that you observed and that you wrote and talked about is that when growth slows, the immediate reaction of companies is like they try to become more efficient. Obviously, you know,
yes.
When there's less turnover, they focus on efficiency. And you say that is completely wrong. What should they do instead, or how should they think about this?
I think that the problem is perhaps not that it's completely wrong, because it's very human, that when you see the first signs of your growth slowing down, of course the first thing, I mean, it's like your personal life, right? I mean, if you have a job and somebody tells you like, wait a minute, next year I only need you on 75%, so I need to cut your hours. And then you just realize, what am I going to do? Well, you need to cut costs, right? So, of course, it's human. The problem is that a lot of companies mistake that for strategy and for health. I mean, it never is. It's just like you have to do that as hygiene, especially like when you just have to face a reality. But the problem is growth will not come from there. And here's some really staggering stuff that I found that sort of changes my worldview. I've tried to map every listed company I could find. So I've found a database of 150,000 companies in the world listed on all kinds of stock exchanges. And I look at their financial performance the past 10 years. Most of the companies in the world are shrinking. It's very counterintuitive. But they are.
Because everybody talks about growth, but very few actually manage to grow.
Yes, exactly. Mm. So you have like a very strange distribution where it kind of peaks around the inflation rate, which means standing still, zero. Then it's a sharp drop off. And then you have like the hero companies that actually grow and thrive for various reasons. So this is a very different map. And to me, it's a little bit like, yeah, you know, something qualitatively different is going on when the companies are growing from sort of the mean mode. And this is, and this also, which I think is even more for our marketing listeners, which kind of blew my mind, is that I went back to 2014 and I checked what are the world's most valuable brands, according to Interbrand and Brand Z. And, I did a comparison where I could find 2024 financial follow-up data 10 years later. And you see the same thing. Most of them are shrinking. And that's the best top valuable brands in the world. And you still have this normal distribution around a minus 1%.
Just to illustrate this, like in front of our mental eye, so we always see this Interbrand like outperforming the MSCI world, but that is only achieved because there are a few outliers within the group of those brands that what you just described, that are growing so strong and create so much market value that overall that index is, yeah, is more successful than other indexes. Is that what, yes, you're saying?
So what you see, if you can picture this in front of you, imagine a normal distribution where the mode company, the most, the peak of the first normal distribution is at -1% net. And then you have a lump of fast growers.
And so what do these fast growers, what do they differentiate? Like how are they different from the ones that are sitting still or even shrinking slowly?
Well, this is the thing that when I started like really looking at this, I think that also a lot of people tend to dismiss the whole question. Like, you know, well, that's innovation, that these companies are technologically superior, the ones that outperform. But I really started to sort of look closer at, you know, I had a...
Can you give some examples just so people know what kind of companies we're talking about? Like what are the ones that are stable or shrinking, and what are those outliers that you found?
Yeah, so the fast growers, I think that a lot of people dismissed that by, oh, it's innovation, you know, because they were backed with a lot of venture capital. But I kind of controlled for that. Number one, it's not venture capital. I mean, of course, it can be present, but I'm looking at revenue growth. So if you're giving your stuff away, you will not have revenue growth, obviously. So it's a pretty good control that you're actually selling real stuff and getting the money in. But number two, when you look closely, I had a study group of about 150 companies that I studied a bit more closely. It's across B2B and B2C, and a lot of them you haven't heard about because they are not sort of on your radar unless you're in the sort of B2B world they're in. Mm-hmm. But most of them are not at all driven by technology per se. It's a very common misunderstanding that these companies sort of have invested in some kind of breakthrough R&D thing that make them own something.
Can you give some examples what kind of companies these are, which are not so technology-driven, but nevertheless, they are outliers in growth?
I think, like, you know, easy ones to understand is, for instance, Spotify or Uber or these kind of companies, because their technological platforms, yes, are important to what they do, because it's sort of, say, a superior solution, but it's not technologically...
Yeah, they didn't invent Bluetooth, for example, or something like a completely new thing.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of people think that it's all about the sort of IP of, you know, we own this and nobody can sort of attack us because then we can sue them because we have this technology. No. It's very uncommon. And so that was really like my first clue to the sort of growth mechanisms. And the second that I really, really obsessed about is that when you look at exponential growth for companies like, I mean, some of the better known on the list, so that I don't have to explain, but, you know, Tesla or Spotify or Netflix, for that matter, these companies grew so immensely fast that you cannot really explain it even with advertising, because if you sort of start doing the calculation of an ever expanding addressable audience that they are marketing to, they would be spending literally billions of dollars in advertising. And you know that some of them, like Tesla, are sort of almost famous for not
advertising. Yeah. I mean, they had a spokesperson which was all over the news constantly. So in a way, it was indirect exposure, like Elon Musk being all over the place.
Exactly.
In the beginning, being positively associated with, oh wow, this is like the new frontier of creating innovative technological solution, and later hurting the brand. But nevertheless, like lots of exposure.
Yes. And it's very interesting also, like, you know, the chicken and the egg thing, you know, would Musk have been so popular if he did not bring, so to say, new interesting value with his brands? I believe not. But you have other things like, for instance, Spotify, where Spotify Wrapped is called marketing. You know, they release like your annual kind of profile and what you've been doing last year music-wise and stuff like that. That's actually a product extension. It's a very good demonstration of when marketing is product, right? And so you see that, you know, I mean, Spotify, although they have a marketing budget, cannot be explained in terms of the market in relation to their addressable market. Yet somehow they have continuously been able to be remembered and bought by ever increasing numbers. So the other thing that I really felt was that it's just interesting that what I learned now from marketing science and the stuff you mentioned in the introduction is that somehow they overcame these constraints to growth. What I think is a bit different though is that I think they are constraints to growth rather than drivers of growth.
Mm-hmm. For example, like being platforms like digitally available, like the easy to find was not the problem because you could easily download them wherever you are. Like once you had the mentally, basically, you were available for them being a solution, the friction of accessing the service obviously was very low. You know, within seconds, you would have the product, which is in traditional retail a little bit more difficult to get onto the shelf in the supermarkets because it's a big controlling factor. Mm-hmm.
It certainly is. I mean, it is, as I say, it's more like constraints rather than the drivers in themselves. Because I think that this is where I started like really thinking about it. When I looked closer, what you can see is that these fast-growing brands that then grow over like a 10-year period, not just like as a fluke because they're like in fashion or they just sort of time like a world event or something like that, but they really grow consistently, is that they address new demand points that lay outside what other people have offered before or resolved before. And what I mean by a demand point is that when you sort of have a need of some sort, a situation where you feel like, you know, this is sort of say a problem or a wish of mine, and I wonder if I could resolve it. And I think that the consideration set that we are so happy to say, then people enter a category. No, first of all, the brain kind of like wonders, like, do I know any solution to this or not? You know, and if the answer is not, you just have to sort of grit your teeth and get on with your life, you know. You don't have a consideration set at all. If you do have a consideration set, it's not really like, and science shows this, four decades of research, that people don't have stable categories in their head. They make up various options in their head depending on the exact situation. And they use that to sort of make a decision, and then they dismantle that again.
That's a very strong point. Let's double click on that because that's very important. Like categories don't exist. Like everybody, what categories don't exist? Like so, what you're basically saying is there only exist demand, and then you think about the solution for that demand, and whatever the purchasing manager decides what he calls a category to lump certain products together in one shelf, psychologically it doesn't mean anything to people. They have the demand of moving from A to B, and then the bicycle might do, or the ride share, or having your own car, or the public transportation, or whatever, just walking, getting some good walking shoes. So then suddenly the walking shoes are in the same category as the drive now or
exactly. I think this area, it's in my opinion, it's one of the low points of marketing practice, and I think it takes a lot of effort to reprogram your head around this, that categories do not exist other than frankly industry convenience. If you run a supermarket, you got to organize it somehow. So people agree that, you know, let's put this stuff together with this stuff, you know. And the way categories typically is used also is actually taxonomy. You know, it's like how things that look alike go alike. But, and that is a way of describing the world. It has nothing to do with underlying needs or functions. It is simply like a way of just imposing structure on customers. I had a guy that was like really flustered when I said this because he had been working with building online stores for a long time. So he was like, oh, of course categories exist. Because he said, like, you know, try to make an online store without categories. It's impossible. And I was like, yeah, sure. But, you know, it's you who decide what these categories are, isn't it? I mean, you don't have a customer that runs that show. It's just up to you. So
basically what you're saying, these companies, like you just said, they innovated on how to define also the like the solution space, like the demand point. Yeah. Like to in what demand point they want to play, not in which category they want to play. Like first, like being empathetic about what people want and then catering to certain demand points. And the growth, correct me if I misunderstood, growth comes from discovering the demand points that you can service eventually maybe better or more often or demand points, just discover demand points. Like the demand point of Uber was new, like reducing the uncertainty when the taxi will arrive. That was before. It was just you ordered a taxi and it came when it came. Yeah. And now suddenly it says, okay, the demand point is, but they don't like that friction of waiting for that car. So we show them a little car on the map and we say, oh, it's three corners away. It's going to be there in 4 minutes.
Right. And it's kind of funny because I think that the best way of sort of understanding this is like, you know, you could draw like the demand space of taxi before Uber. And here are all the situations where people use taxis. But there are also situations now where people use Ubers or maybe taxis that have sort of finally copied them. For instance, because they know the price beforehand. And that removes a hurdle to, in certain situations, actually take a taxi where you otherwise wouldn't. You know, for instance, if you don't always have like cash on your account, right? Mm-hmm. And number two, like, you know, I'm standing there and I'm like being really stressed and I'm wondering whether getting an Uber would actually help me get to where I need to go faster than try running or sort of taking a bus. And I can kind of see that by their map service. And then, boom, I have some more demand in the space for these services. And I think that it's this kind of thing that is the core of what I'm observing, that when companies go for efficiency, they don't look for these things. They only look inward. What are the primary reasons people take a taxi? It's because they want to go from A to B. And they worry about, and they only buy on price, they say, and they see their whole world sort of shrinking in. But instead, if you have the other perspective of growth, you more go like, where are the hurdles to growth? How can we expand this space? And okay, when you do that, other things happen too, but that's the core mechanism.
But that's a very relevant message at this moment, because there are going to be many companies that are going to be challenged for growth. You know, we have maybe an economic crisis out there coming. Overall markets will be shrinking, so companies will be shrinking. How I understood what you described to me is that basically when they only then focus on efficiency, they basically reduce the future. Yeah, like they should need to look out for new ways of serving demand and all those. It's like let's make it in the metaphor. Like you said, you know, next year your client will only demand 75% of your services. Obviously, you need to reduce your costs, your personal costs. Maybe, you know, like don't buy the second boat, maybe sell the third car or whatever. But what you shouldn't do is save on, for example, Congress tickets. Yeah, like where you go to discussion panels in your industry to learn how the industry is shaping, or on your budget on visiting seminars where you could meet new clients, because seminars are great places. You're 2 days intensively in a seminar together and you discuss, and people might and then basically how I understand it is like you must create surface for the future. I just had this picture in my head. It's like basically like not reduce. You said you were they're closing in, so basically reducing also the surface for serendipity, for good things to happen to you, for discovering something which creates a lot of value. Is that please correct me or add what I was missing there.
No, I think you're on it. I mean, what I think is the grand tragedy in a way is that exactly the thing I said about when you ask people, like, you know, why do these companies grow like crazy, and everybody says innovation, they also assume another thing, which is they must have pumped billions into R&D before they sort of got started. They must have had so much cash and la 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 la. And I think a lot of good management people have like been really burned on these sort of like very bet the company kind of attitude things that come a little bit from the startup mythology, you know, like you bet the company over and over and sort of become big. But I think that this actually operates at a much more humble level. Like, do you actually have some people who still have the time to even look at what your customers are doing and what their problems are? Do you just spend like, you know, a fraction of your operating expenses on actually figuring out how people even use your products, and more importantly, how they don't use them?
What keeps them from using?
And I think that is the sort of shift I want to sort of give. I don't want to sort of present this thing, which can sound very bleak, right? That most listed companies are factually dying, you know, a slow death. But I don't want people to see it as like I'm coming like with dark tidings. I think that the contrary is that growth is hard, but it's still easier and less risky than we are led to believe, because it is an attitude more than it is a capital allocation in the first round. You just got to give your people a chance to see where the market is going. And many companies in their hunt for efficiency have just basically prohibited people from being curious. And that is the danger.
And I think if you look at some of the companies.
No problem.
Like Google obviously is a good example of outgrowing everybody. And they seem to understand also that you need organizational slack with your people to come up with ideas that can be game changers. So they have this 20% rule that you can allocate your own working time. 20% you just whatever you're interested in, because they know again creating surface for serendipity, for people coming up with the next Google Maps or there's one I wanted to support what you just said is like in Germany we have many hidden champions, and these are really specialized in a certain field, and why are they like that? Because they know their customers intricately, like really the details, and they're out there very very often in touch with the customers. They observe, they talk, and so on, and then they just change slightly their offer. So in the end, even if you are in a you have a cheaper you produce in Taiwan or Korea or Vietnam or whatever, but you just don't deliver the same kind of value because of all those small details, which come together. So and that what I found intriguing in your demand point constellation, which I had in my head like a star sign up in the sky. So it's not the single star, you know, that's not the only reason. The meaning comes from that constellation. So I'd like to talk about that that mental model that you created there.
I think another thing that I really found was that I started looking for what I kind of call the dark matter of awareness, right? I mean, since the popular view a little bit is that if a company is growing, it needs to grow its mental availability or awareness or recall measures. And how is that done? Well, typically, you know, if you look at smaller companies, we kind of know the scene. I mean, you can start out by being a small B2B company and you have like a really good idea and you got something to sell. So you can just basically go word of mouth. You personal selling, like you just call some people you know and ask for recommendation and you sort of like get your first clients. After that, you go into a phase where actually only, so to say, pretty aggressive advertising will work for a little while. You can just like put out a very clear offer and get some of them. But as we know, anybody who's working with advertising these days knows that that will also sort of level out and you will have to pay more and more and more attention to the long game. That is preparing people who are not presently in market to call you when they need you. So that's sort of say what a lot of people think brand building is, and in a way it is. But even that will level off, you see, because if you look at really fast growth, there is no way you can explain the fast growth by advertising. And there is something that then takes place. And to some extent, of course, we can say it's PR and the kind of like Musk effect and social media that people talk about things. But why really, like, why does it stick in people's heads? And then I went to linguistics as well as neuropsychology and how memory works, but even more so, how new words enter language. You know, we have learned new words like brain rot or doom scrolling and whatever. And why do these things come? Well, because we have a need. It's like a phenomenon that's actually kind of complex, but it surfaces every now and then. It's very useful for us to have a label on it. Mm-hmm. So you can talk to very oddly, like all people who are fluent in English know what brain rot is and doom scrolling is because it's just useful markers for a bigger phenomenon in our world. And here's the catch. At a certain point, your brand becomes conceptually like a word. Sometimes this is quite literal, you know, when you Google something, but it's sometimes this is an effect, but we don't think about it that way, like a word that becomes a verb. But Netflix is like, you can just say Netflix, you know, what are you going to do tonight? Netflix. And it means a lot of stuff.
Even if you watch Prime. Yeah, even if you watch Prime or another video on demand, but it's Netflix, yeah.
Yeah, Netflix and things. Exactly. And you don't have to sort of explain the wider concept. And I think that, you know, Spotify became the same thing when people simply ask, like, you know, do you have Spotify? Because it implies a lot of things. Like, you know, I can start streaming onto your speakers now and let's have a party. So I think that this is what I call linguistic compression, that the whole brand meaning across all of these demand points gets linguistically compressed into the brand name.
Like Kärcher in Germany, you know, like the cleaning company that is high-pressure cleaners. And we right. say, das wird gekärchert. Yeah, so basically it becomes the verb of high-pressure cleaning is kärchern. But that's basically the pinnacle of brands. Like the people listening out there are working for medium-sized brands that like what does this mean for them? Is like, is this achievable for them?
Yeah,
or is that something the winner takes it all effect? There's going to be one Netflix in that category and we're all going to be followers.
No, I think the first is don't think category. Because as long as you think category, this will never happen. Mm-hmm. Number two is look for the demand space and look at your borders and look for the friction and the sort of demand points that nobody's currently serving. You will not see him by the naked eye because you have to sort of be a detective. You have to be patient and you have to accept that it's weak signals that you can turn into something. But finding, so to say, those things that we talked about, for example, with Uber, like what makes people in these circumstances not even take a taxi? That's what we want to look for. And if you do all of these things right, you actually start levitating meaningfully above the people you use to compete against. Mm-hmm. And that's actually also something that I think is a law-like thing, that you have outcome dominance. That is, at some point, it's not about the consideration set, because you will not even be in a consideration set. You will just be a go-to solution in given situations. Mm-hmm. And this is what creates sort of hypergrowth when you start reaching that level. Because, I mean, we talk a lot about Uber, but it's fun. I'm here in Brazil. Other taxi companies exist, and I'm aware of them. They have awareness, but I never used them. There is absolutely zero reason for me to even think about using them, because everything for me works with simply using Uber for everything, because it's also like administratively superior and everything just clicks in place. So outcome dominance is another explanation of this, that you don't really dominate your category. You even made your old category irrelevant. You're not even there.
Which is the original goal of creating a brand, a psychological monopoly in people's heads. That's and right. What you're saying is also search for valuable words that you can own. Yeah, it's like often quoted as an example, but it's good. It's like Red Bull was the first energy drink. It wasn't a super cola that makes you more awake. It was the first energy drink. And so suddenly there was a new category. So that's a valuable search field to look for. What else is there that words are important, semantic, you called it semantic compression? Linguistic compression. So think about your category. What are the words you want to own? And is there a way, like Rolex, they don't have luxury watches. They have professional watches. Yeah. So these are watches for professionals. So you have the engineer, like for people working in environments with high magnetic fields. You have the submariner, which isn't even could be a person. He's the submariner. Yeah. So this is a professional watch, the first diving watch. So that's Rolex is a good example using that linguistic compression by creating a word that in the end describes a certain function that it represents with all the meaning behind it, who you are as a person when you own one of these watches. Okay, so that's something for our listeners to do, like look into your category and look for the words which describe your special type of demand point constellation that you service, and then you can compress it with. And this way you can get a psychological monopoly, not a patent.
That's right. I think one of the things that is very surprising to me is that one of the things that is counterintuitive to old school positioning is that these fast growers actually have grown so fast in terms of what they address that they sort of break the old rules of have like a very clear and simple position vis-a-vis others and stick to that. And I think that is actually something that has dawned on me, that is a profound difference between what I'm saying in the demand point constellation conclusions versus old school STP, like segmentation, targeting, positioning. Because the segmentation, targeting, positioning still kind of starts with an assumption that demand space is already defined and finite. And you position yourself in relation to the others. And I'm saying you're not positioning, you're just simply outgrowing them. You just are so much more useful and therefore meaningful for people. So they will simply abandon those competitors. As like a more limited thing that is no longer worth paying attention to.
But couldn't you switch that model into your thinking? Because like the way you segment, you can segment people like socio-demographic factors, which are very stable, which is very stupid because we learn that they move from demand point to demand point. And in one demand point, they might choose this brand, another that brand, and their income hasn't changed, where they live hasn't changed. So basically, isn't it about the way you segment it that could still serve like the segmentation, targeting, and positioning? Because even Red Bull positioned itself into something new, like basically saying we're in an energy drink, and so there's no comparison. And because there's no comparison, suddenly there's no price anchor, and suddenly they can charge a completely different price for something that is new.
Right. I think that the problem, though, is that all segmentation kind of like needs some kind of thing to segment against, which is typically existing buying behavior. So that, I think, is the sort of flaw, that since the signal is already what already exists, it will still be an efficiency play and not a growth play. So
disruptive growth, basically what you're saying is disruptive growth needs creativity in creating a new constellation of demand points. And that is not to be found in existing categories.
Exactly. It's seeing outside of the existing space. That's what it is. And I think I've likened it a bit like, you know, if somebody is astronomically inclined, like for some reason I ended up with this sort of idea of the constellations, but I also like in astronomy the story of how they detected the dwarf planet Pluto. I think it was in 1948, if I remember it right, but I'm not sure. But they didn't observe it directly, but they did observe things around it, like for instance the erratic movement of Neptune. So they could gradually conclude that there was something out there, even if they couldn't see it directly. And I think that that is the kind of thing that is your future demand points, that if you already see that people are doing this in this situation and buying that, it's actually within somebody else's demand space already, right? So, you know, you could try to sort of steal it over if it's like not at all associated with what you currently do, but it's more this thing, you know, that it is about being a detective and sort of finding, like, you know, what the problems are, the hurdles are to sort of consuming more of your stuff. And I think that that is the sort of the key thing where people go wrong, is that in this day, because everybody's so efficiency oriented, they expect it to be like a clear signal that there are X amount of people buying Y amount of stuff that we could produce for this price and surely make a profit. But if you do that, you're already, it's already in your demand space. So you're actually only kidding yourself that you are thinking about growth. You're thinking about efficiency still, right?
It's the I like that picture of blue ocean and red ocean strategy. Then you're still in the red ocean where everybody is fighting. You want to go into the blue ocean where the competition is reduced, where you are free as a whale in the blue whatever. You can become a whale. You can grow into a whale because you're in the.
I really like their work, and I think that I think what DPC does is that it bridges a little bit like the strategic thinking about offers into like how you can actually both detect them as well as getting them across, which for various reasons is not really within their scope. But I love their work.
Yeah, what I'm hearing is that what you just described with the demand space, existing demand space, is always an existing service, an existing product, an existing behavior. Yes. But what you described as the search field is more like a motivational opportunity to serve a motivation that exists. Because in the end, if it doesn't exist, if the need for reducing the friction of waiting time while ordering a taxi, if it doesn't exist, we cannot service, obviously. But it's a completely different way of looking at what we actually want to supply. It's because it's very difficult to make an existing product 10 times more efficient. But it is possible psychologically to make an existing fulfillment of a demand 10 times more enjoyable than everything else. That was the iPhone moment for me before always pressing on your phone, and then suddenly you swipe and you know everything becomes so easy and there's a large screen, and it's a different way of serving.
I think it's so interesting to sort of illustrate my point once again, that I spoke to a person only this week about the smartphone business, which of course still interests me because I have my roots in it. And what happens now is that, you know, we used to buy phones that cost like almost 2,000 euros, right? The top of the range. And that was the norm, has been the norm ever since the smart, like the iPhone came in 2007, for instance. That's like almost 20 years ago now. And I mean, if you can't afford it, you sort of buy, you buy the most exclusive phone you can find, but that's no longer the case. Now the heat in the industry is like the mid-range, and we're talking 500 euro, 600 euro. And when I hear that, I'm like, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Now everybody is going efficiency play because this is reality, they say. We got to like really compete in the mid segment. That's where all the money is going to be. And everybody's rushing to make like the ultimate sort of say 500, 600 euro offer. What do you think will happen? It will collapse, of course, because they will take away any reason to sort of overpay for the expensive phones. And if this is true on a large scale or just, you know, one person's project, I don't have the data. But if this is true on a larger scale, I would definitely short Apple and Samsung because then they are screwed, right? Because obviously if the average sales price is going to drop like 60-70%, it's gonna crush that industry. And instead, what should they do instead? Well, for all this time, there were new demand points that were actually being served by the smartphones. We had better cameras. We had better connectivity. We had nicer screens. We had all of these things that actually gradually pushed the demand space wider and wider and made people happy because the sort of meaning of these new phones still justified staying on at that price. And now it seems like that era is over, and that's pretty dramatic.
Because the added tangible value has before it was always big jumps. There was a big jump in tangible value switching from my Nokia communicator to my first iPhone. And then from generation to generation, and it's a little bit like with Gillette with the sixth blade or something. You know, my three blade XL does the trick. You know, my beard stays, my skin stays smooth. So why should I buy a six blade? And add so much. So the question there is, where's the next jump in tangible value, and how do we find out what is the evolution, the next demand point frontier?
I think that is quite interesting because yes, it was a hardware race when I was in the industry on the inside. It was a very fun time because we did so much of the first, like the first camera, the first GPS, the first real keyboards you could put on there, and Bluetooth and everything. And also the sort of physical form factors were actually amazing in their own right because the phones physically look different. Now it's all sort of converging into one.
Would you call Bluetooth a linguistic compression? Like that
happened. It is. Huh? I mean, you just say Bluetooth, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's it. I mean, and nobody even thinks about, like, you know, are there alternatives to Bluetooth?
Are there alternatives? Are there technical alternatives? No, there's Bluetooth, that's it.
Well, in a way, one of the things that it crushed was that there was, for instance, DECT. If you remember old wireless phones in your home, that ran on a standard that could easily have become, so to say, Bluetooth.
Yeah, but it was called DEC, the DEC.
DEC.
But isn't that interesting that Bluetooth, the word, is so much more memorable and so much more emotional than DEC? Yeah, the DEC standard is used for this, is it Bluetooth?
But I cannot explain in words how much my stomach hurt the sort of morning we were going public with the name Bluetooth.
Yeah,
I thought, oh my God, you know, are people going to like just go ballistic? Because it was hard to say, you know, now we're used to it and everybody in the world knows what it is practically. Mm-hmm. But imagine
the TH sound is for the German tongue.
And people said Bluetooth.
Bluetooth.
And a lot of people frankly said in the beginning, but it's so hard to say, and what is this? But the thing that we rested on was that people, a lot of people who were sort of like really into technology also, they sort of shown up when they heard Bluetooth and said, that sounds so interesting. That sounds very modern.
Yeah.
So we went with that.
Interesting. Another point I would like to talk about is with the demand point constellation, the value of certain demand point constellations. Like you use IKEA as an example of maybe we can illustrate that well, because we're talking about complex stuff here. The brain hurt scale of this episode is quite high. So I would like to try to make it as tangible as your beautiful illustrations. And one thing was like you said, like frequency matters more than intensity, for example, in demand point constellations. And maybe we double click on that a little bit and describe it with the IKEA example.
Yeah, I think that it's just it's out of the sort of principles of both linguistics and neuropsychology on memory that you need frequency to not forget things, right? So brands that try to build it where you very, very seldom have sort of say the situations where you are in contact with them are simply gonna be less effective than if you have like a strong stream of experiences that constantly reinforce, right? Mm-hmm. This is not controversial. I mean, this is what people are saying more in kind of like advertising contexts. I'm just saying that.
Oh, I misunderstood that quote then, because I thought you were talking about moments of needs, like what do we focus on as a brand to grow, and we take the moments of needs which are more frequent and not the ones which are more intensive or like more meaningful, and then people are willing to spend more. The more valuable points are basically the ones that reoccur often and you have a habitual
exactly. So I am talking about that. I just like made a parallel to that on a lower scale. That is kind of like the effect also of advertising. Like if you are there often, people will not forget you in the moments that matter if your advertising reminds. But I'm saying that at a higher level, this effect reinforces itself much better, of course, with the frequency of moments when you experience a brand. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be dramatic to be useful, because that's not what it is. Like, we're not falling in love here. We're simply like dealing with our lives. And if there is something like IKEA that solves a whole shebang of different problems, we can even sort of like cope with the kind of like less than joyful sometimes experience of actually going there, because we sort of like, as a solution to a shitload of problems and situations that face us in life, we can resolve them by going to IKEA. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit what I mean.
Is IKEA still in the group of fast growing companies that you analyzed?
Oh, that's a very good... No, the problem with them is that the sneaky guys from Sweden are not publicly listed.
Right.
So I can check.
Okay.
Otherwise,
I would assume that international expansion still fuels growth for them. But obviously, so we can't talk about that.
Yeah, I don't know the details simply.
Because
it's not transparent.
Yeah. So the difference, try to summarize a little bit. It's like, okay, traditional marketing is like thinking, okay, we're going to build our brands with campaigns. And one big difference is you say brands grow from looking for situations they not want to own, but they want to be the natural solution. That's just comes up. Yeah. Yes. And if that works over time, it becomes the linguistic compression, then you become the default solution for that. And so the brand in itself is basically an essential system of situations in which you become the natural solution, and you need to reinforce the memory structures that aid the retrieval in those moments.
Yes.
And So there, basically, you go, you are d'accord with Aaron Burke Bass completely. You say, okay, that all makes sense. But where do you differ? Where do your paths split a little bit, or you say that's not complete?
I think number one is that it's really like what I'm interested in, and I think it diverges on two things. The first is that I'm not interested in static competition, one can of soup against another can of soup. It's not my commercial reality nor ambition to sort of like say what holds brands back in like locked competition. I am looking at, you know, what makes some brands just totally sort of escape the normal gravity of growth, which is in kind of a way, I think, sort of almost like the ones that they would call outliers are the ones that is my population.
Can you give an example? You don't have to even like just describe, you don't have to name the company with a client where you achieved that and how you achieved that. So basically make it practical in a way that how do you identify the demand points? How do you manage then that realization within the company? How do you create acceptance by buy-in from the top management? Can you walk us through the process that you find, or which is probably a puzzle of experiences that you had?
That's a ginormous question, I know. But one quick thing that I think is a good one that I like because it's so clear in its effect was. One company that sold like financial solutions for saving, like primarily for pensions, they were forced to switch names, and they contacted me. And at first, they were just like very locked on the practical implications of changing a name, like, you know, how much do we have to invest for people to remember the new name and these kind of things. Gradually, we realized that the real hurdle was not actually about the rebrand per se, because they were so B2B that they were selling all their products through insurance brokers, and they knew every single insurance broker. So the day we would switch names, we could ensure that everyone had a personal call, personal meeting, where we could present what was going to happen. So then basically when we got to that point and we realized, we said that, you know, now, you know, you can rest that this is not a problem. This is an opportunity. So now let's look at like, what does the market look like and what is not currently being served so well? So we started looking for the frictions, and we started looking like, you know, what kind of things do people would the brokers really need in their portfolio that would make like a meaningful difference in their recommendations. And they put together a few products. So when they actually had the D-Day, we had like this big, very personal rollout towards all the brokers, not to end users or anything. Like that was their problem, but we were very sharp on what we could contribute and why and how. And then on top of it, you know, and by the way, our new name is X, you know, and they went overnight, they increased their turnover by 20%. Wow. Overnight. That's beautiful. It was like one of these like bonk, you know,
And that's, I love that. The very good story, because in the end, it's all a brand experience system. Why do people buy in the end? Why they are trusting or have an expectation of performance? And there are certain touch points which are much more important than many other touch points. And what you said, your most important touch points at that point is the recommendation of the broker. They need to be convinced. And what you created is material for them to then communicate to their clients. So that is the, you don't have to pay for that, but the client obviously learns your name by the sales pitch that you taught these insurance brokers. And by doing that, you could, it's the most, it's the strongest also way of teaching clients the new name is by connecting it with a solution, something, a value proposition, basically. And it's a great way of thinking about these things. That's a very good example.
And a fun thing. It was quite light on the whole sort of like, you know, the kind of thing that we call purpose or like identity. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much a story about what this company would
practical.
Be. It was just like, this is what the market needs.
Yeah, so, there's change here. Yeah. We change our offer, which is going to be better, and this is the way it's better. And by the way, we also have a new name. So the positive change is connected with the new name, and suddenly you have an association in the heads of the broker, which story to repeat. How did you identify in that case what the market needed more, like what the brokers needed more, or but the brokers needed to sell it to their clients? So did you do like market research with the clients? Like what kind of products in what combination were a better solution
I think this is like one of the few things where I think it just has to be bespoke for every single occasion. In this case, they actually were sitting on a lot of unresolved tensions themselves in sort of the stories of frustrations of this, of these partners being fed back to them that just had been unresolved for various reasons of sort of say like, this is the way it just has to work and stuff like that. And we said, we're like, what if we actually resolve that? But sometimes that is not enough. And I mean, there are like 20 different ways that you can sort of address these things, like how can you discover where you should be looking, but there is no standard way because it differs a lot between B2B and B2C and what kind of stuff you do and so forth. So here is where I hesitate to just say like, oh, you do it like this, because I really think that is part of the sort of thing where you have to be there to sort of see how you do it.
Let's drink our own poison and apply, look at the barriers, like this new way of thinking to introduce this into the organization. What are the main barriers that you experience in making people think differently? For example, say, hey, you don't work in a category. You basically, in the future, you're going to do your market research differently. You're going to think differently about this. What are the barriers and what tips could you do, could you give to remove them or...
Well, one thing is to sort of like try to get this thing that you resolve something that other people really don't, which I'm trying to do with the Manpoint Constellation, which is actually address what real growth is, not interfighting within a pre-established locked market. So in a way, like, you know, I think that my demand points are outside the existing demand space of the theories, I would hope. Number two, I think that I have created things that make you sort of like, you know, you can even like, you can have the imagery, like what I'm saying is that your brand should almost be like a constellation in the sky. Like you can see it as a whole and it's like a lot of different connected points that it resolves. Make it easy to think about it. Demand point constellations, that it has a name that you can remember and think about. And hopefully, you know, if people really think about like, how can I sort of get my company out of stagnation? They will think demand point constellations and not think about alternatives really, hopefully. So I think I think I kind of done what I can. And then also like, you know, the visual assets that I create around it, I think is kind of funny in a way, because that is straight out of the playbook of also of Ehrenberg Bass, right? I mean,
very distinctive.
Distinctive brand assets. And I think it's kind of funny that I think I really live by it, perhaps more than EBI does themselves.
Absolutely. And do you create them yourself?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
You do.
Wow, well, with the help of AI, of course. But
But you managed to stabilize the style, which is it's like a band that needs to find
I have their had, sound. I also have a very brilliant colleague, Per Elin, who is he's a strategist as well, first and foremost, but he's also an excellent designer, and he helps me kind of. He yells at me whenever he thinks that my quality is below par.
It's dropping. Yeah, okay.
So there is no escape. But I really enjoy doing that part. Yeah.
Yeah, and people out there enjoy it a lot. Definitely, I know many fans of your cool. of your carousels, and you educate the market. So to wrap this up, maybe I would like to look into the future and say, okay. This new way of thinking, evidence-based marketing, with the addition of thinking more like in demand point constellations, because they explain better why brands grow, in the sense that don't look for only being available in category entry points, but be superior because you offer something different, which creates more value. What would you wish for that people do not talk about anymore in 5 years? And what do you wish for that people do talk about more in boardrooms, in conversations between CMOs and CEOs?
Ooh, I think if I could do a wish list, I would really wish that people could stop using the word category so lightly, because I really think that is like among the worst things a marketer can do, because it really is like, you know, saying like, I'm going to run a marathon, but the first thing I'm going to do is to sort of shoot myself in the leg and make it as hard as possible for me to win. And that is what I think with category. It's self-imposed prisons. And I really think that anybody who hears this should really think hard about what I mean by that. And it will take you some time to sort of understand what I mean by it. But categories do not exist as such. They do exist as choice sets. Replace it with choice sets and accept the fact that these choice sets are never stable. They are situation dependent. And then a lot of things go from there. So that, I think, is maybe like the most tangible thing. The second I would say is that I think that 90% of people in marketing, as well as outside marketing, when they talk about marketing, they talk about advertising. And I think that is also like a great disservice to what this is. Advertising is a specialty within marketing that, and I would put it like this, when I look at DPC, I studied 150 companies and I judged that about maybe 8 of them could be said to be like heavily advertising driven. But 142 then were not. I think, think about that. And I would say also that
and to make advertising then a key discipline for brand building, is the key discipline is stupid because the numbers...
It's exceedingly stupid. And I think that I'm even going so far, and I'm not being popular with it, but I'm even going so far as to say that I think that creativity is like totally overrated as well. I mean, as much as I love this stuff, you see it. I mean, I live on creativity and creating stuff and communicating. But you gotta face reality, man. I mean, this growth is not caused by advertising. However, I think most of these companies could have grown even better with really well-used advertising. So I'm not belittling that advertising. I'm not saying advertising doesn't create value, but I think that the problem is that I think that marketers should drop the self-identity that they are first and foremost some kind of like, you know, I am like an advertising person that understands business.
Is so important because creativity is a tool, and there's what you described, I think we could reframe creativity, because finding new demand point constellations is very creative. Yeah. It's something where you have need a deep understanding of people, what drives them, their motivation, their friction, their frustrations, and then creating something which creates a better solution for them. That is the kind of creativity that is economically valuable. And I other creativity to be different just for the sense of being different and everybody saying around you, oh, you're so creative, that cannot be the goal. Of that's good point. So that was the second point. Is there a third point? You don't have to, but is a third thing that you wish for?
I think also, like, you know, really understand in the future, like, culture, that an organization that is just hell-bent on being more efficient will most likely at the same time be hindering any hope of long-term survival. And it's that drastic. I think that the moment that takes over, the company is dying. And I think that you gotta think that, you know, in order to grow, you must find a bigger demand space.
And that is effective. And the efficiency will not lead you there.
Exactly.
It's like, that's very good. That's a very good third point. Which leads me to one of the brand codes of Markenkraft, which is the closing question. If you have this one sentence, this one impulse that you can give people that they see in the morning on their smartphones, see on their laptops when they open it up or at the desktop, what would this one sentence, this one impulse, what would you give them for the next year?
I don't know. Maybe my candidate would be that efficiency optimizes what exists. Curiosity creates what's next.
That is fantastic. Let's repeat that very slowly one more time.
Efficiency optimizes what exists. Curiosity creates what's next.
Fantastic. Full stop. Mats, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
It's challenged us to look deeper. It was really, I think the brain hurt scale was high, but I think that the last, like the last minutes, I think it became very tangible. And we learned that brands don't grow from PowerPoints or big campaigns. They grow in real situations in people's lives and understanding them better and serving them better. That's the insight that unlocks disruptive big growth that you talk about. Thank you very much for sharing your thinking.
Thank you so much.
Und das war's für heute. Vielen Dank, dass ihr dabei wart. Wir hoffen, es hat euch genauso viel Freude gemacht wie uns. Wenn ja, empfehlt Markenkraft euren Freunden, euren Bekannten, euren Kollegen und hinterlasst eine Bewertung. Es hilft enorm, dass andere diesen Podcast auch entdecken. Share the love for brands. Macht's gut für euch selber und die Menschen in eurem Leben.